From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. A pair of controversial security bills pushed through Japan's parliament by Prime Minister Shinzo Abe were approved, effectively killing the remaining anti-war provisions of Japan's post-war constitution. There have been massive protests across Japan opposing the move. CCTV's Chuan Shen-Chen reports from Tokyo.
Japan's purely defensive posture is under revision. The security bills represent Prime Minister Shinzo Abe's bid to break what he sees as the shackles of Japan's post-war pacifist constitution. The bills will enable Japan to engage in armed conflicts overseas and help defend its allies, even if Japan is not attacked, otherwise known as the right to collective self-defense. Abe has said the move aims to protect the Japanese people from new threats. But opponents fear the revisions could entangle Japan in U.S.-led conflicts around the globe.
If we allow the security bills to be forced through, Japan will be taking a very big step toward becoming a country, as envisioned by the Liberal Democratic Party, that can easily use military power abroad.
As the parliamentary session got underway, thousands gathered outside to voice their anger.
It feels like the Constitution has been destroyed. I made this sign myself, which say we won't allow the destruction of the Constitution.
If they pass the bills, that means a big shift for Japan to become a country which can fight a war. We can't accept the bills as they affect the direction of the country and our everyday life.
Polls show that about 56% of Japanese are against the bills. The bills will now go to the upper house, and if no vote is taken after 60 days, they will be returned to the lower house, where Abe's coalition can enact them with a two-thirds majority. Chen Chen-Chen, CCTV.
A day after Greece approved a series of measures demanded by its European creditors, Germany's lawmakers, after a simmering debate, approved Friday the opening of detailed negotiations aimed at providing some debt relief to Athens. One question raised during the debate was whether Greece and the EU would be better off with Athens leaving the European currency. Chancellor Angela Merkel and her finance minister, Wolfgang Schäuble, had urged Parliament to back the bailout, which both called a last attempt to order Greece's finances. It would be Greece's third bailout in 5 years, negotiated with the goal of keeping the country in the eurozone. 439 German lawmakers voted in favor of moving ahead with the deal. There were 119 votes against and 40 legislators who abstained. Resistance to providing more help to Greece was strongest among conservatives. Meanwhile, Greece's Prime Minister Alexis Tsipras reportedly reshuffled his cabinet Friday amid mounting opposition among ministers and deputies from his ruling Syriza party over the new bailout package. That move was being viewed as an effort by Tsipras to show Greece's creditors that he remains in control of the government. Another series of Saudi airstrikes pounded Yemen Thursday with more civilian casualties. At least four areas in the country, Aden and Sa'ada provinces, Ibb province's Rada district, and the capital, Sana'a, were targeted. Casualty reports were not available as of press time Friday, except from Sa'ada province, where three civilians were reportedly killed. Press TV's Kanis Fatima has more.
Saudi Arabia continues its military campaign against Yemen despite international calls for a halt to the assault, at least during the Muslim fasting month of Ramadan. The Saudi military has conducted two fresh airstrikes on Rada'a district of Ibb province. One of the strikes targeted a residential area. There are still no reports on possible casualties. At least three civilians were earlier reported to have died in airstrikes on a residential area in Sa'ada. Saudi planes had earlier struck several civilian targets in Aden province as well as in the capital Sana'a. The Saudi aggression has so far killed over 4,700 Yemenis, most of them civilians. It has also displaced over 1 million people. Let's cross over to the Yemeni capital Sana'a and speak to our correspondent Mohammed Al-Attab. Now, Mohammed, the end of the fasting month of Ramadan is supposed to be a festive occasion. However, it's mired in blood for the Yemenis now, isn't it?
Yes, the Yemeni people are living through difficult times, and also during an unprecedented circumstances, especially with the continuation of the Saudi bombardment as today they are marking the Eid al-Fitr occasion, which is one of the important religious occasions for Yemenis and also for Muslims. The such continuation for the air bombardment have also created a catastrophe in this country. Then now people are, even though they are marking these important occasions, they are going through difficult times with the continuation of the and the deterioration of the humanitarian situation in the country because of the continued bombardment that has displaced many people, and also that has also left many people killed and injured. So far, the Yemeni people are relentless to continue their daily life, and also to celebrate these important occasions. The mosques are full with people, and also the people today are visiting their relatives, even though that the Saudi warplanes continued their daily what they described the Yemenis genocidal war against them, even though the they have in defiance of this such a continuation of the air bombardment, they have taken to visit their relatives and also in different parts of the country. So far also the Saudi Arabia has targeted the important air base of the capital Sana'a, which is a Dalami air base, and the smokes have been seen coming out of this the air base, which is during the early hours of the day. Also, they have targeted also another air base in Aden. It's Al Anad base. They have also killed many civilians there. The Saudi Arabia is targeting mostly the Aden in an attempt to allow and enable the militants, Al-Qaeda, also militia men there, in order to enable the fugitive former president to return back to the country. The army and the popular units have strongly defeated this, such attempts, and also in the defiance against this, what he described as Saudi domination into Yemen.
On Friday, Saudi-backed forces of Yemen's fugitive former president, Abd Rabu Mansour Hadi, claimed to have taken the southern city of Aden from the Yemeni army and Yemen's Ansarullah fighters. However, witnesses on the scene said that clashes were still ongoing in the central part of Aden, with the city's defenders still in control of a number of districts. Hadi's Saudi-backed forces began operations to seize Aden Tuesday. The city has seen fierce fighting for the past 4 months. Meanwhile, the Yemeni army and Ansarullah fighters launched fresh attacks on Saudi positions in retaliation for the ongoing airstrikes by Riyadh. They reportedly blew up a military tower and fired rockets into a military base in Jizan in Saudi Arabia. Meanwhile, in a further demonstration that the Saudi war on Yemen was coming home, there was a car bomb attack Thursday in the capital, Riyadh. The driver of the vehicle was killed, and two police officers were wounded in the explosion at a police checkpoint in the city. That attack was condemned by UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon, as Deanne Penn reports from the United Nations.
UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon said he was particularly saddened and angered by the attack, which came ahead of the Eid al-Fitr holiday. The holiday marks the end of the holy month of Ramadan. Mr. Ban expressed his sympathies to the government and people of Saudi Arabia. He also wished a speedy recovery to the two officers injured in the attack. Deanne Penn, United Nations.
As of press time Friday, there were no reports that the UN Secretary General had condemned the loss of civilian lives in Yemen as a result of the Saudi air raids. This week's agreement between the so-called P5+1 countries and Iran continues to be the subject of much speculation and concern among officials and politicians here in the U.S. and in various capitals around the world. Among the issues being raised are the possible change in U.S.-Iran relations going forward and what that could mean for the entire Middle East and Southwest Asian region. For more on that, we spoke with Eric Dreitzer, geopolitical analyst and senior editor of the website StopImperialism.com. We spoke with him via telephone from New York Thursday. What's your take?
Well, I think that there's a number of reasons why the United States has pushed so hard, and there's obviously very concrete economic and political reasons why the Iranians have pushed so hard for this deal. I think first and foremost is the fact that from the Iranian perspective, they've been looking for normalization of relations with the international community, especially with regard to economic relations. While the sanctions have not crippled the Iranian economy entirely, they've certainly made it difficult for Iran to develop at the capacity and in the way that they would have liked to. So from that perspective, they're looking to integrate themselves into the grander global economic system. And so for them, there was a clear economic reason for them to do so. Also, they're looking for political normalization to be treated as equals within the international framework. Of course, the United States and Israel and their allies have really kind of turned Iran into a pariah, globally speaking. So the Iranian imperative, I think, was quite obvious. But from the perspective of the United States, it's a bit more complex, because if you were to listen to mainstream media, they would try to convince you that Obama is doing this for a purely personal political reason, for his legacy, or because he's weak, or something along these lines. But the reality is that it is U.S. economic interests, the U.S. ruling establishment, that has been pushing so hard for this deal, because Iran is, in many ways, one of the great untapped markets in the world, a massive country with tens of millions of people ready to buy consumer goods, a market and an economy ready to be opened up to finance capital, to investment, and to all of the global capitalist interests. And so, from that perspective, Western finance capital, especially in Europe, as well as energy corporations, they have seen Iran as a major prize. And so really, the deal is, in effect, the political triumph over the forces of the Israel lobby, over the forces of those who would seek to undermine this deal. But this is not to say that the deal is necessarily a great one. It is not to say that it doesn't come with severe concessions from the Iranian side, which it absolutely does. So in many ways, the narrative from the mainstream media has been upside down. Yeah. That is to say, portraying it as a huge victory for Iran and a tremendous defeat for the United States and for Israel, when in fact I think the reality is quite the opposite.
You know, what's interesting, if you go back in history to the beginning of, well, it was not the very beginning, but in the post-war period, the oil, the major oil reserves that Iran has were in the control of British oil companies, and after the 1953 coup, it was American oil companies. So the U.S. had a very, very heavy hand in Iran, beginning with the coup against Mossadegh, which just coincidentally worked out to put Iran's oil in the hands of the United States until 1979. Do you think some oil companies are salivating now?
Well, yes, absolutely, although the reality of it is that it is less the U.S. oil companies and more even the European oil companies which see Iran as the great prize. Right. Unfortunately for ExxonMobil and its American competitors and sisters, it is going to have some severe difficulties because of some of the U.S.-specific sanctions, some of the other difficulties that they will face because of American legislation, but it's European competitors, especially companies like Francis Total or even BP, they will actually stand to benefit tremendously from all of this. Remember that Francis Total was on the verge of a major deal just a few years ago in 2007 when the latest round of sanctions were imposed over the alleged nuclear weapons program, although the nuclear program has since, I think, been a discredited narrative. And it is those French companies, those Italian companies, those British companies, some of the others from Europe who stand to gain the most, specifically with regard to the Iranian energy sector. And then, of course, we shouldn't forget that Western finance capital, hedge funds, investment funds, wealth funds, all of them are salivating over this deal because they've already made the preliminary preparations to enter into the Iranian market. They already have partners in Iran willing to make the necessary investments, to make the necessary partnerships partnerships in order to generate tremendous amounts of revenue from all of this. So there are billions to be made, and that's why there is an economic establishment, a ruling establishment inside of Iran, which is celebrating over this deal. But that celebration is more about their profits than it is about Iranian national interests, in my view.
And is it possible that we might see behind the scenes here in the United States a battle of the Colossus, AIPAC on the one hand and oil company lobbyists on the other?
Well, in many ways, that's true, and in fact, that's exactly what's happened. And in some ways, it goes to dispute this, I think, somewhat oversimplified notion that the Israel lobby controls all legislation, controls everything that happens in Washington. Rather, it is capital that controls what happens in Washington. It is the economic ruling class that controls legislation, that controls political developments, and there is a fight within that ruling class right now in the United States over this deal and over the potential of Iran. But the real reason, and this is something that is almost never discussed in any of the mainstream media or even much of the alternative media, is the simple fact that the strategic planners, in the United States see a tremendous threat coming out of Iran, and it has nothing to do with the nuclear program. It has everything to do with political and economic integration with the Eurasian states, especially with Russia and China. They are desperate to integrate Iran into the Western-dominated global finance capital system rather than to keep it isolated and force it to move closer and closer to China, to Russia, to the other BRICS countries, to the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, which it recently has acceded to. This potential outcome would be disastrous for the United States and for U.S. hegemony all throughout the Eurasian space. And so they were desperate to make this deal, even if it goes against the interests of the powerful Israel lobby. And this is one of these major points, that Israel and Saudi Arabia have interests that in many ways, on the case of Iran, diverge from those of the U.S. ruling establishment, especially from those who have a little bit of vision.
And converge as against each other. Finally, the Iranian Revolution was in 1979, and the U.S. involvement in Afghanistan began around the same time. That involvement, of course, spawned Al-Qaeda and all the other groups that have flowed since, and created a rift within the Muslim world along the lines of Shia and Sunni. That was exacerbated and encouraged and nudged along in Iraq and other places, but you have essentially the Sunni side identifying with the interests of the U.S. and the EU, acting as proxies, even these terrorist groups, especially these terrorist groups. And on the other side, Iran, which was an adversary of the United States. If that dynamic changes, in other words, at the moment you have the potentiality that you mentioned of Iran getting closer to this rising geopolitical alternative to the West. On the other hand, if they can co-opt Iran, what does that do on the ground to this Shia-Sunni thing? Because you mentioned what's happening in Syria. You can look around a number of other spots in the Muslim world and the Arab world and see where suddenly you'd be seeing sides change.
Yeah, and I think that you're hitting at a really important point. And I would say, though, that this is where one needs to make a distinction between Iran's economic interests, those of the business elites of Tehran, and its political and its military and strategic interests, which really, I think, haven't changed since 1979, and especially since the Iran-Iraq war, that Iran still is, in many ways, the number one enemy of the United States and of Israel and their allies in the region, regardless of what happens with this economic push from the West. And so this is part, I think, of the strategy that certain quarters of the U.S. ruling establishment have been pursuing. They want to create a split within Iran's political body. That is to say, they want to make a different set of interests, one set of interests for the business elites, another set of interests for the political leadership, and thereby they would like to foment divisions within the political body of Iran, where the interests diverge and thereby being able to exploit those divisions. In other words, to neutralize some of what Iran's influence in the region would be, because, of course, Iran is, in many ways, the principal engine of resistance throughout that region, as they've demonstrated over the last 18 months. Iran has shown quite clearly that it is by far the most effective force in the region at fighting ISIS, maybe with the exception, of course, of the Syrian military, but that Iran is a major force to be reckoned with militarily, and it is a major bulwark against the forces of terrorism that are financed by Saudi Arabia, Qatar, and some of the other Gulf monarchies. And so, again, this tension between the economic interests and agenda of certain quarters of the Iranian establishment and the political and military agenda, I think that this is part of the grand strategy, and one of the ways that they're hoping to make Iran into, if not less of an adversary, at the very least a neutral party, one that cannot really act with the same vigor and energetic quality that it has over the course of the last few decades.
In response to a question about the possibility that Tehran will use some of its funds being unfrozen with the lifting of sanctions in ways that run counter to the interests of the U.S. or its allies in the region, State Department spokesperson John Kirby on Friday at his regular press conference said this.
I can't stand up here and tell you that none of the money that will be unfrozen, once they comply with their agreements, it's not an immediate thing. They have to comply with their end of the deal in order to see sanctions relief. I can't stay here and tell you that none of those dollars could be devoted to, you know, further destabilizing activities. What I can tell you is that regardless, if those destabilizing activities continue, we have means, the United States, and our partners and allies do as well, but we have means to continue to thwart them and deal with them, whether it's sanctions or improving partner capacity of our allies and partners in the region. All that's going to continue to happen. And I think it's also worth noting that this is an economy that is in need. There are other needs President Rouhani has to deal with. I mean, I can't speak for how he writes his checks, but there's a lot of infrastructure to the tune of almost $1 trillion. That the country needs, and other domestic spending issues that they have to deal with. So, you know, a wise leader would want to use whatever extra cash is available to deal with the needs of his people.
Washington itself, in the eighth year of the worst economic downturn since the 1930s, apparently feels no such pressure. On Thursday, it was reported that the U.S. offered a $15 billion increase in military aid to Israel to help salve its concerns about the nuclear deal with Iran, with Defense Secretary Ashton Carter expected to make the offer during next week's visit to Tel Aviv. The new arrangement would go into effect in 2018 and last for a decade. As part of Bolivian President Evo Morales' visit to Argentina, thousands of workers rallied in Buenos Aires to support La Paz's demand for sovereign access to the Pacific Ocean. Bolivia's claim against Chile is currently being considered by the International Court of Justice in The Hague. It has received broad support throughout Latin America. Morales reaffirmed Bolivia's support for Argentina in its dispute with Great Britain over the Malvinas Islands. Telesur's Lionel Poblete reports from Buenos Aires.
Bolivia's international campaign, which seeks to promote awareness on its demand of sovereign access to the Pacific Ocean, arrived to Argentina this Thursday, where thousands of workers gathered in a rally to demonstrate their solidarity towards the cause.
We want Bolivia to reunite with its dream. We want Bolivia and the Bolivian people to break through the Pacific Ocean, through the unity of all Latin Americans, with our Chilean brothers, with Argentines, Brazilians, build the unity needed to confront the injustices, the exclusion, the imperialism that entrusts the oligarchies of our nations.
The demand for sovereign access to the Pacific Ocean that Bolivia claims to Chile, a country with which it fought a war in the late 19th century, in which it lost its coastal territory, is currently being heard at the International Court of Justice at The Hague.
Bolivia is certainly gaining a lot of support from across Latin America, so that the access to the sea it demands can become effective at some stage. Let's hope The Hague hears this that he hears that feeling of Latin Americans and he gives that long delayed yet so desired sovereign access to sea for all the Bolivian people.
The Argentine Workers Central organized the event and described it as an opportunity to reflect on closing the gaps that can be obstacles in the way of consolidating the unity of the nations of Latin America.
Many thanks for this display of support, brothers and sisters. I am sure that the Bolivian people will never forget these huge rallies of support in favor of justice, of a demand. I must say with great clarity that we are campaigning for Bolivia's return to sea with sovereignty.
President Morales also insisted on defending access to sea for Bolivia and the restoration of the Malvinas Islands to Argentina in a nod to Argentina's claim of sovereignty over the South Atlantic Islands, which are in British hands since the 19th century.
On behalf of the plurinational state of Bolivia, Evo Morales has come to ask for solidarity from Argentine workers. Thousands have come here to say that they're with Bolivia in its claim to have access to the Pacific Ocean. From Buenos Aires, Leo Politico Guti, Telesur.
For more on what's happening in the Latin America and Caribbean region, we go to our reporter from south of the border, Tony Solo, who spoke with us via Skype from Managua, Nicaragua, Friday.
There's so much going on. I know we had the tail end of the Pope's visit.
He was in the last leg
of his visit was to Paraguay. And that was in many ways a historic visit. Perhaps we can talk about that a little bit later.
Wondering, while he was there, did he happen to sound like the Marxist that he sounded like in Quito? Because they kill him
there,
don't
they? There was great consistency to his declarations during his visit. And very, very much, obviously, and he reinforced his message in Bolivia very much against... or very much in favor of serious action on climate change. And it's very important that he said that in Bolivia and maintained that message all the way through his visit, because he went to, where did he go to? It was Bolivia, Paraguay, and Peru, I think. Yeah, and his first stop was Peru, wasn't it?
Yeah.
And then he went to Bolivia, and then he finished up in Paraguay. But it was in Bolivia that he made a very powerful speech to the social movements, arguing passionately for the need for serious action by all countries, but especially the rich countries, to combat climate change. And the other stuff going on, and there's here in Nicaragua, we just had an opinion poll, and Daniel Ortega and his wife Rosario Murillo, who in practice functions more or less as the country's prime minister, Rosario Murillo has a popularity rating of something like 75%.
Right.
Daniel Ortega has a popularity rating of 72%.
Mm-hmm.
Now, and this is not a left-wing polling company. This is a mainstream center-right polling company. They're called M&R.
How do them dictators like Ortega and Putin draw like numbers like 70% and 80%, and the U.S. Congress draws like 8%, and yet they get reelected at a 90% rate here in the United States, even though everybody hates them?
I think
them.
It might have something to do with campaign funding.
And the media.
Right. So then, there's so much else going on. Evo Morales was visiting Argentina recently, and there was a very important symbolic event there, when President Cristina Fernandez and Evo Morales inaugurated a statue, in honor of an Argentinian anti-colonial fighter called Juana Azudui. And she's a fascinating figure in herself, but the importance of the event last week was that they took down a statue of Christopher Columbus and put up a statue in honor of Juana Azudui, which is actually paid for by Bolivia.
Nice.
And Juana Azudui was a female military commander. I think she was born in something like 1780, something like that. But she took part for all her life, all through her life, she took part in campaigns against the Spanish colonial power. And at one point, she was leading as many as 6,000 men.
Wow.
And she survived. She survived to see Argentinian independence. Finn completed her career as a military leader in the Argentinian army, died in poverty.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.